The Restoration and Empowerment for Social Transition Center is a Peel Region nonprofit organization serving BIPOC youth who are either experiencing or are at risk of experiencing homelessness, supporting them to change their story, discover new possibilities, and shelter dignity. This podcast, Homelessness and Hiding, Are Youth Between the Cracks, is an uncensored discussion of content that may not be appropriate for all listeners. Personal discretion is advised. Hello and welcome to Homelessness and Hiding, Our Youth Between the Cracks, a podcast discussing youth homelessness in our communities while elevating the voices of those with lived experience and the people on the front lines fighting against it. Homelessness and poverty are really complicated issues that so often feel like they're being overlooked by the people in charge. With the skyrocketing costs of living and the harder it becomes to find deep-cut, affordable housing, it's so easy to feel like everyone's last priority. Have you ever wanted to talk to somebody about that? Have you ever wanted to have your voice heard and validated and contribute to the possibility of change? I'm Maya Moniz, your host for this episode, and today I sit with Counselor Martin Reed, the new counselor for Mississauga's Ward 9, which covers Meadowvale and Central Erin Mills. Since November 2022, Counselor Reed has been dedicated to connecting with his community, hearing their vision, and figuring out ways to help them prosper. Today, we get to know a little more about who he is, how he wants his community to heal from poverty, and how he plans to use his position in office to amplify the issues that matter to us. Hello, Counselor Reed. Welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
I am wonderful.
Great to hear. I'm not even much of a morning person, to be honest with you, so I'm still working on that. It's something about finishing university and realizing I have to abide by a normal schedule. Something with the university life, you just have to, you're up all night half the time.
Right. I feel, honestly, I was the same until we had kids and I realized that, I can get the most work done before the world wakes up. And then I became a morning person ever since. So, I'd be up early, do my thing, and try and get as much stuff done before 9 o'clock as possible. So, this is midday for me almost right now.
Oh my goodness. I think for me, I'm the other way around where it's just, I find I'm more productive at night. But then of course, I have to stick with what the rest of the world needs of me. So maybe I should just try switching. That seems like the better approach. But that said, Counselor Reed, please introduce yourself and tell us anything you would like for us to know.
Sure. Well, my name is Martin Reed. You can call me Martin. You don't have to go with the Counselor Reed. I'm fine with whatever you want to say, but by no means do I expect you to kiss my ring and call me Counselor. It's good. So I'm a counselor for Mississauga Ward 9, which is Meadowvale, Central Erin Mills, and Meadowvale Business Park. And I'm a newly minted a counselor. This is my first tour of duty, so to speak. And the lady who was in this role before me was Pat Sato. She was there for 31 years. I lived in this area my whole life. My parents moved here, probably one of the first Black families here in 1977. So I lived in this area, went to all the schools in this area. And I just feel like I'm just part of the fabric of this community. So it was just a real natural progression for me to want to give back in this way, right? So,
well, thank you for that. Could you describe a little bit of what it means to be a ward counselor in the region of Peel? And of course, there's that looming cloud in the air that in a couple of years, the region of Peel will not exist. But ignoring that for the sake of time and for the sake of simplicity, could you describe what it means to be a ward counselor in this current day and age?
Yeah, absolutely. When I'm talking to young people about it, I explain it this way and say that it's like you're a mini mayor and you're kingdom, or however you want to explain it, is a small area. So Meadowvale and Central Erin Mills, the schools, Meadowvale Secondary School, John Fraser, Gonzaga, that space, I'm the person who represents the residents. And if you need your snow cleared, or there's a path that you want, or there's something that, accessible playground facilities or bike paths, that sort of thing, anything that makes this place safer, more comfortable, more livable, more enjoyable, I'm responsible for that. And then the Mississauga counselors are also regional counselors. So all 11 of us as counselors for our respective wards and municipality are also regional counselors. So then for Mississauga, Brampton, and Caledon, we're looking at things like roads and waste disposal, et cetera, and all of those services, homelessness, housing, seniors, early childhood education, all those things that fall under the regional umbrella, I'm responsible for that as well.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying. Honestly, that was very helpful. And we'll get a little more into how community members can connect with you if they ever have concerns, but that's later down the line.
Absolutely.
But first, what do you want to get out of this conversation today? Because I know this is kind of like, it's kind of an interesting space to be. Some organization knocks on your office door and is like, hi, could we talk to you?
Yeah.
So that said, what do you want this to be?
Well, I've had a podcast in the past where I talk to people and I always start with their origin story and get an understanding of why they are in this seat. So just looking, full disclosure, looking at the questions and they're all, you know, pointed towards my social work background. If this was, you know, one of the other counselors, you may be talking about their financial background or their legislative background or their, you know, their business background. So, and for me, my heart and my background is all in like human services to some degree. So I think it's just for people to see me and the person behind the seat, you know, because a lot of times as counselors, you all get thrown in as politicians and then you don't really get the understanding of what people's area of passion is or what their actual area of expertise or their niche is. And for me, it's all, you know, relationship building and connections and community stuff. So I think if we're highlighting that and centering on that, that's probably what brought us together in this conversation.
I think that's a really good point you raised there. I feel like I at times can also fall victim to lumping politicians together as politicians, but that's absolutely a very integral point to consider, is that everyone has different backgrounds, everyone has different expertise. And I do just want to say for the listeners is that, like, I've already seen your commitment to like social work and social service work. Like, we actually met briefly last week, I believe. I think it was June 6th. We met at the Peel Poverty Reduction Committee's Action Summit. And if I'm remembering correctly, the title of that summit was "Will Poverty End With Us? A Collective Call to Action."
Yes.
And that summit was, honestly, it was a privilege to attend. It was a very eye-opening experience. Like, Rest Centers was there. Martin, you were there. There's also the Peel Poverty Action Group, the Peel Alliance on Homelessness, Moya Health and Community Services, so many more, but forgive me, I'm forgetting a lot of them off the top of my head.
Yeah,
but essentially what the summit was just to kind of come together as community members and service providers to engage in poverty-adjacent conversation about where is poverty currently sitting in the region of Peel and how can we come together to fight it on the lines of housing, income, security, employment, and food security. And so, yeah, truly, like, that was such an amazing experience. And the fact that you were there, like, I think I had seen you kind of in the corner of my eye at one point. I was like, hold on a second, is that Martin Reed? I'm surprised he's here. I'm glad he's here, because I feel like so many people in power, like, don't make time for stuff like this. That's kind of what I've seen. For that, I want to say thank you for not only showing your support, but like giving your ear and listening to what we had to say.
Well, no, I appreciate that. And, you know, a lot of us in the social services, I think, like, I felt like I was amongst my people being there, right? So when people were like, wow, you stayed the whole day, I'm like, yeah, like, isn't this not worth staying the whole day for? Like, I don't know. Like, I feel that's just who I am. That's what I do. And if I can afford to do it, I'll do it. And there's times when, at the same time, where I walk in, give her a certificate and leave because I have to get to the next event. But I, like, that was circled on my calendar. Like, if we're going to really move the needle on homelessness and poverty and stuff, when you have those people in the room, you need to make time. When you have like all just a cross section of the different areas of expertise and institutions and nonprofit organizations and levels of government, like, you know, there's people there that can actually make a difference when everyone's in the room. Like, together, there is the opportunity for you know, maybe a phrase that sticks with someone or just an idea to ask someone. Like, so many things can happen. I would just want to be a part of that. And I see that happening with the police too. Like, we were complaining and everyone's really frustrated with like auto theft, for example, and they did an auto theft summit, and they not just had police talking about what to do, they had like three different police forces and the manufacturers and the insurance people. And you know what I mean? So when you have different people in the room, you have to take advantage of having different voices in the room if you're actually going to make change. So it was a no-brainer for me to spend the day with you. So that's just where it comes from for me with when it comes to these matters.
Absolutely. It was my first summit ever that I had the privilege to go to. And I truly felt like I was part of the room. Like, they brought out chart paper, everyone. It, like, we were there and we were writing down ideas. It was very, very impactful. With that in mind, I do want to ask you a little bit about how you've ended up where you are. And you've said before in other mediums that that was because of the work of Pat Sato, who was the previous ward counselor for Ward 9. So please, if you may, what about her work inspires you? And why is that such a big part of what you want to continue?
When I was... I just came out of university. I did my master's in marriage and family therapy, a master's of divinity in counseling and marriage and family therapy. I did my undergrad in social work at the University of Waterloo, played football there the whole nine. So I was working in a drop-in setting. I was a housing coordinator working with youth at risk, using the phrase couch surfing on top of everything else 25 years ago. So it's pretty frustrating to hear couch surfing still a thing, but that's on a sidebar. When I was working for this nonprofit, The Dam, Pat would be there because, she was a counselor for the last 31 years. So when I was just starting at The Dam 25, 26 years ago, she would be there. And every time that we had a dilemma, we were losing our space or we needed new space or there was a fundraiser coming up, she'd show up with the check or she would have a connection for a new space or she would be able to speak to the property managers and extend our lease. There were so many ways that she allowed us to continue to do our work. So from her seat, she was enabling us to do our work for young people in our community. And I remember that because like, I want that job. I want to be the one that is able to do that. And I saw her, I was like, I could totally do that job one day. I have no clue what that job entails, but I see this one corner of it and it's pretty cool. And basically 31 years later, she retired. So I'm like, okay, I'm in. Like, you know, like I wanted to jump at that as soon as I heard that she was retiring, because I know that she was one who was always supporting us, always amplifying our work, and always connecting us to the right resources for us to be able to do it.
Wow. That's amazing to hear, because I feel like you don't often hear about people in places of power just doing what needs to be done. And again, we will get into that a little bit later, the process behind everything. But I actually had a follow-up question in that regard. And forgive my ignorance with this question, but of course, like, ward counselor is an election, right? It happens every 4 or 5 years?
Every 4 years, yeah.
Every 4 years. And so he was reelected that many times.
Right. And in between there, like a little bit of history, like there was like, I believe 2 and 3 year terms in there. And that's why it doesn't land on like 36 or 32 as a multiple of four. So that's where she's at with that. But yeah, I mean, overall, it was one of those things where I just saw the work she was doing and saw the work she was having in the community. And every job that I've had has always been measured by what is the impact that I can make. I've never chased a dollar, never been like, I'm going to make six figures doing this. I've always gauged every job opportunity by how much impact can I have from the seat. And that's kind of led every next opportunity.
And especially why I highlighted how many years she was reelected, it shows exactly how beloved she was in her community and how much good she was doing. And so to hear that you kind of just want to take what she had done and run with it, absolutely. It makes me feel like we're in good hands, you know?
Yeah, I hope so. You know, and that kind of circles back a little bit to what we were saying about the conference and everyone being like, wow, he's there all day. You know, I've been doing this for a long time. I've cared about my community for a long time. And I feel like all of us need to recognize that we're leaders with or without a title. And I was a leader in this in many ways in a small scale. And the scale got bigger and bigger. But like, I've always cared about homelessness. I've always cared about young people. I've always cared about poverty. So just now that there's eyes on me, it doesn't change the fact that this is what I've been doing for the last 20 years, regardless of whether I was running my fitness business or in full-blown social work. So it's a part of who I am as opposed to what I do. So at this point, people are now seeing what I've been doing and pleasantly surprised by it. But I'm like, it's the same as any one of us. Like, we've been doing this. This is who we are. You know, so it doesn't matter that there's eyes on me now. I'm still doing it. And I've been doing it before you saw me. I'll be doing it after you're finished looking at me. I think people who are passionate about this stuff kind of have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder. Like when I was campaigning, some lady saw me in a grocery store and she saw how I was like doing, I get coffee and I do giveaways and I'd be at different spots and I'd just connect with people and hang out with them. And then the lady said, like, if you win, are you going to continue to do this? I was like, I was doing this before I was campaigning. Like, I'm not doing this because I'm campaigning. Like, this is what I do. So yes, like, one, I'm hoping I'm going to win. And two, I'll continue doing it because I was doing it before I was even campaigning. Like, you know what I mean? You get to a point where you're like, I'm not doing this for you. I'm not doing this for your eyes.
Absolutely. And so I feel like my next question is almost a little redundant in a sense, but because I'm asking, it's like, what legacy do you want to leave behind for yourself? But that's not why you're doing this. So I'm going to try to tweak it slightly and say, what impact do you want to have had by the time you are done in office, whenever that may be?
It's funny. I haven't even really thought about that. I'm not going to be like cliche and say like I live for today, but I mean, I feel like that slogan campaign, support, amplify, and connect, is kind of like my lifetime campaign. Like, it's my motto. And if I'm always supporting other people doing the work and always amplifying the work that they're doing and always making sure that these right connections are made so everyone feels connected and just thriving, it really doesn't matter what my legacy is, as long as the dam is still around 60 years from now and that, you know, organizations that were just fledgling organizations trying to figure out where they're going to get their next dollar could be like institutes, like complete part of the fabric of our community, and they're doing their work and don't have to worry about where the next funding dollar is going to come from, because I've amplified their work so much and because we have done so much work to show that they are an integral part of our community, whether it's a church, a mosque, a synagogue, a nonprofit, atheist organization, whatever. Like, whoever is trying to help our people are doing their thing and don't have to worry about chasing dollars to get their thing done, I'm happy. Like, doesn't matter what my legacy is, as long as people see them doing their work.
I appreciate that. Thank you. On the note of support, amplify, and connect, when I first saw that motto, I thought it was very interesting, because when I hear support, I think of like scaffolding and foundation. So making sure that that's in place. And then when I think of amplify, I think of course, an amplifier, like a speaker, of course, just kind of spreading the word. But then connect for me is a really big one. And I feel like it's especially timely in the current state of the region of Peel. When it's like, we should be connecting more as community members, as service providers, and as citizens in this region. But then in a broad lens, in 2 years, we are disconnecting. And so I think it's absolutely important and integral that organizations work together and build those partnerships to make sure that the people we serve are getting the best care that they possibly can. Because the reality of the situation is that certain organizations only serve like certain demographics because that's what they're catered towards and that's what they are best equipped to do. But then on the other end, you have other organizations that could serve certain demographics better, but then they're not getting the amplification or the support they need in order to do that. Like, they haven't been able to build those connections. So I think it's an interesting motto to live your life by.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And just on the connect thing too for a second, Maya, like, I think that there's a sense of I think of connection as more of like an ecosystem, right? So when you're connecting these different pieces, you use example of one serving a certain people group or a specific target audience. I think that that's fine. I think that, you know, if someone is doing like the Walnut Foundation doing prostate cancer testing and awareness for men, specifically South Asian and Black men, that's a great niche. And they don't have to dive into breast cancer awareness. Like, and they don't have to, you know, dive into vaccinations or whatever it is. Like, that you can stay in your lane and do that well. But when you have this ecosystem, making sure that somebody else is taking care of that piece, all we have to do is gather everyone who's taking care of all these pieces to make sure that we can identify our gaps and then bring them into the fold as well. So that, you know, that's why I loved that that poverty action group conference, because you had the dam, you had Roots, you had University of Toronto, Mississauga, you had, you know what I mean, like public health, like you had all these different human services from the region of Peel. You had everyone there and everyone has their niche. So that's great. Like, let's celebrate the fact that they have their niche. Let's amplify their specific niches and make sure that people are connected to them.
Mm-hmm. I have a bit of a follow-up question for you, and it might be a little bit of a toughie, but I want to know how you might suggest that we, you know, that we support, amplify, and connect on a very practical level. Like, what are things that we you know, as citizens in a community, the community at large, governing parties, service providers, what are things that we can do to support, amplify, and connect?
I have to ask a question before answering that, and have to understand specifically what a person's area of passion is. You know, what do they want to be connected to? Who do they want to help? What's important to you? And then from there, I would connect them with the group that's doing that. Volunteer your time, go to their walk, do their fundraisers, like repost their stuff on Instagram, like do whatever it is to amplify the person who is already doing that work. Like, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We just need to come alongside those who have that vision. So that's kind of how I'm running. That's not kind of, that's definitely how I'm running my time in office, is like, there's a few things that are very important to me, and I'm pouring all of my energy into those things. And that means that I won't be able to get to every event, and there won't be committees. There will be committees that I'm not going to join, because I trust that my other colleagues are passionate about those things and that they could do that well. So I use Councillor Joe Hornick as an example. He's a fantastic person when it comes to finances, and he's a former banker. And so he loves the finance stuff. So he runs the finance stuff, but that doesn't mean that he can't talk to human services or that he doesn't care about, you know, community safety. And in the same way, I ran a business for 20 years. Like, I understand finances and numbers and stuff, but like, I'd rather work on cultivating relationships than talking numbers all day. So for everyone out there, what does it mean to support, amplify, and connect in their own, and what's their practical level to it? I would say just latch onto someone's vision, latch onto the organization that is doing something that's important to you, and be more involved. They need bodies, they need numbers, they need money, you know, so be that, be those resources that they need.
Since entering office, have you found any particularly helpful resources in, or rather, for people to find what they're interested in? Like, is there any kind of, I don't want to say database, but like, is there anything that you have found that has helped you in sort of getting to know your community and the different action groups within it?
That's a great question. There is an organization called the Open Window Hub, and they were based out of one of the libraries in the Port Credit area, I believe. They got some funding, they started their thing, and then they moved to Central Library. And I hope the story is right. I'm not sure about the details of it, but basically with the Central Library closing down for the renovations, they've been a bit nomadic, and they have one location at the Meadowvale Community Center on Mondays from 9 till 4. From talking with them, this is a Region Appeal partly funded program where they help newcomers, they help people, just giving them resources. You could just walk by and ask a question, and they can point you in the right direction for food, shelter, passports, and everything in between. I love this program, and I'm working in the background really hard to have it running 5 days a week out of the community center, because they are slammed all day long with people just asking questions, sitting down, guiding people, that sort of thing. So I find that having that as a one-stop shop in the Meadowvale Community Center, which is almost a city unto itself, is like this beautiful community center that is just bustling with everything from swim lessons to seniors groups all day long. They need that resource as a one-stop shop to know what resources are available to them in the region, right? Like, they're not just Meadowvale or Ward 9 or Air Mills. They're regional resources. If you need to connect for daycare, they can give you the resources to get your daycare, right? So that's the one, Open Window Hub. Like, I'm really working hard in the background to see how we can make that, you get that in the budget and have it 5 days a week in Meadowvale. Like, all the organizations that do great work, that's awesome. But like, if people don't know where to go first, it's useless, right? Like, it's futile, because they don't know where to go first to find out where to go next. So they just kind of wander, and then that's when you couch surf, and that's when you have someone making some calls for you, and that's when maybe you end up, the police find you, and then they're helping you. And that's like, you don't want to start your path with the police, right? Like, I mean, they're there to help, but I'd much rather meet them when it's not the worst day of my life.
Yeah. Cause especially, you know, one thing goes wrong, and if you look a certain way to the police, it almost feels like it's all downhill from there. And I say that as a Black person. Like, it's just, it can be a very, of course, the obligatory statement of like, not all cops are bad cops. And I do thoroughly believe that. But of course, you know, there's enough bad apples that it kind of changes the entire perception. And that goes for absolutely anything. Like, we at Rest Centers, we work with BIPOC youth, and we are Black focused. And so we see a lot of the stigma that they face, even though we have some of the kindest youth, like I personally have ever met. Like, they're so sweet, they're so driven, but then no one wants to take them seriously because they happen to be in a bad place. And so, of course, spreading that out to literally everything ever, if enough things get a bad social perception, then it kind of makes people afraid. And when people are afraid, they do things that they normally wouldn't do. And it's kind of an endless cycle.
Actually, that's one of the things that being in this role, I've been working very closely with the police for many years in different capacities. And I recognize, too, that while they're trying to change that perception, there are departments like their divisional mobilization unit where they have social workers that go out with them, so they can address people when they're in, you know, in need of more mental health needs, where, you know, officers may not have the capacity to deal with it. You can send out a social worker who can address that call. So they're trying to find ways to work around that so that it's not the same narrative of a person having a mental health crisis and the police overreacting and escalating quickly and someone gets shot and like all these different things. They're doing a lot to try and change those narratives. And, you know, that work's being done. I feel like I need to amplify that work as well, right? Because we get locked in our 3 years ago narrative about the police or our 5 years ago narrative about the police. And, you know, I'd like to think that things have been changing. I'd like to think that, you know, being successful in getting a Black man on the police services board lends to giving another perspective on the work that's being done. The fact that we were successful with that helps to show that we are recognizing the need for that representation. And by no means I'm expecting, you know, Len Carby to be, you know, the Messiah coming into the police services board, but having him at the table does change the way that people look at things, the decisions that are being made, and certain things of import. So I don't know, like it's, both are true, and I like to believe that things are slowly improving.
Well, I would certainly hope so, but I really like the point you raised about, you know, just like having like people of different backgrounds like sitting at these tables and like having their voice be heard, and even, you know, just like being on the force, because there's absolutely a lens through which we can look at this from the perspective of cultural insensitivity and like cultural care. Because I think perhaps people who frequently see themselves represented in media or represented by their service providers, this is something they absolutely would take for granted. My point in bringing this up is that I had one youth who had, she was a bit triggered, and I was with her, just kind of keeping her company, comforting her and stuff. And something she said to me really stuck with me. She's like, "You're honestly like a big sister to me, you know? Like, you're like, finally, I have found another light-skinned girl." And that kind of, everything started firing off in my brain in that moment, because she, before now, with every service provider she had dealt with on her journey, she had not once seen herself truly, truly represented. She did not once see herself in anybody before me. And of course, you know, like with the rest of my colleagues at Rest, like we get closer and closer to that. But yeah, no, just the fact that she saw herself in me, and then she saw where I was, and like that was empowering to her. I think it absolutely speaks to the fact that it speaks to the importance of having people of color or people of really any cultural background, religious background, ethnic background, just in these spaces to offer support, because it's so difficult to truly feel like someone understands you if there's always that wall, especially when it comes to any sort of social, like social service issue or social justice issue. Like, there's always going to be a little bit of that cultural disconnect. That does not make it impossible to receive like help and to feel like you're really being cared for, but from what I've experienced and what I've heard from a lot of our clients, makes it extremely difficult.
Right. Well, you know, and that's true. Yeah, that representation matters, and that having a seat at the table is important. And I guess this is, you know, that's one of the things I've been reflecting on quite a bit since I've been here. That notion of having a seat at the table has taken on a whole new life for me, because, you know, in this world, there are so many people who are disruptors, and they're outspoken, they're very smart, they really do a good job of changing the narrative, challenging people, and just turning things over. And I've never thought of myself as a disruptor, but I've seen how being in different rooms, sitting at different tables, how simply being myself, a man, a Black man, having a perspective on social services, or whatever the case is, I interrupt things. I'm not a disruptor, I'm an interrupter. So their regular scheduled program of choosing the person they wanted, or doing the things they wanted, or saying the things they wanted, can't be said or done anymore because I'm in the room. It interrupts the way things are being done because now there's a fresh perspective. There's a different perspective. There's a different skin tone in the room. That changes things. Even if you don't say something drastic or world-changing, the fact that you're there, your very presence, interrupts what was normally going to happen. And that's powerful.
No, absolutely that is. And that's not to say that like every person of color, wherever they go, is the token, because that shouldn't be the case. Like sometimes I just want to exist. Sometimes I just want to be a person. I don't want to have to be a representative of every Black girl who's my age or in my demographic and stuff. But the reality of the situation is that to a degree, and especially, you know, in the work I'm doing and, you know, having my own podcast, like with Rest, like that's kind of where I've fallen into, and I'm not mad at it, but yeah, you know, sometimes it's just the reality of the situation, but you're doing great work in that regard.
Well, no, thank you. I appreciate that. And for you too, the problem is, you know, I've heard people say that. And the more that I hear that, the more I reflect on the fact that it's because you're a leader. It's not because you're a Black woman. As a leader, people will find you. Your leadership, you can't hide your leadership. So you'll be in different rooms and different situations and you'll feel like, man, like this urge, like I have to step up. I have to speak up. I have to volunteer. I have to do this. I got to think of something. You think about, you see something that other people don't see. And then you feel that burden to be the Black person advocating for every person of your skin tone in the greater Toronto area in this moment, because you're a leader. If you didn't have that lens, you wouldn't have even seen it to feel the burden to do something about it.
Thank you for that. I think that just fully recontextualized a lot of things for me.
Yeah, I still put it on you as a leader to choose what you're going to do with it. Like, you know, like,
exactly. Yes. That's why I like the language of leader you're using.
Yeah,
that's, it makes a huge difference.
It's on you. Like, I mean, like my Twitter feed isn't just Black, 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 Black. I'd like, you know, like I have a post yesterday of going to Chuck E. Cheese because I forgot to drop off the certificate when they did the grand opening. So like, it's like me and my stepson, like, playing at Chuck E. Cheese, and that's the end of the post. Like, there's nothing racially loaded, social change needed now about it. It's just like we went and pretended we were kids at Chuck E. Cheese, period. Yeah, it was jokes. So it'd be like, but I think that's it, right? Like, I mean, we got to live it, and like we're controlling that narrative. Like, I just reframe that for you, and you know, that's I think you need to hear that, because we carry it, and then we carry it in a burdensome way. Why don't we carry it in a leadership way, and we choose when we're going to wield it or not?
I like that. Honestly, thank you. That's something I think I'm honestly going to bring back to a lot of our youth at REST, because REST is actually an acronym for anyone who doesn't know, and it's literally Restoration and Empowerment. That's the keyword, empowerment, for social transition. And so a big part of what we try to do is empower the youth to live and breathe and tell their stories from a place of empowerment instead of a place of victimhood. And so that's incredibly eye-opening, and that's something I will definitely be bringing back to the wider team.
My pleasure. That's why I'm here. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's the reason why I love being in this seat, because it just gives you opportunities to talk with people, connect, and just share these messages. So like, that's yours. Like, you can, I don't care if you never credit me for it and you touch 100,000 people with that message. That needs to be out there. Like, you're controlling the narrative, you're empowering people, and you're the one who is really the architect of whatever that change is. And so take it and run with it. Like, that's the blessing of being in the seat, to be able to be in spaces where you can share that stuff.
Before we get back to our conversation with Councillor Reed, I want to take a moment to touch base with you. If you're interested in joining the conversation, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube so we can hear your thoughts on today's episode and you can let us know what you want to see in the future. I come today with some exciting news. The REST Center's Digital Literacy for Life program is back. Digital Literacy for Life, DL4L, is a 16-week program of practical, hands-on training on how to navigate the digital world. Every Wednesday, from July 12th to October 25th, 2023, youth will learn how to get the most out of their computer, tips and tricks to make money online, learn to detect scams, discover the marketing power of social media, and more. To qualify for the program, you must identify as a BIPOC youth aged 16 to 29 and live in the region of Peel. Preference will be given to youth receiving social assistance or low income. To learn more about Digital Literacy for Life and to register, everything you need is in the description. RUSP provides a wide variety of services that center around shelter, living, healing, and growing. Our biggest flagship program is the Bridge of Hope, a socially innovative approach to preventing youth homelessness. In collaboration with our bridge builders, the landlords we work with to house and build the capacity for youth to live independently, the Bridge of Hope program provides youth with a sense of belonging that can only be found in a stable home. We are always looking for new bridge builders, so if you have extra space for rent and are interested in housing youth in need, or if you want to otherwise volunteer with rest centers, send an email to info@restcenters.org. That's info@restcenters.org to learn how you can get involved. In addition to volunteer membership, Rest Centers is able to support youth in Peel through the generous donations of the community. When you donate to Rest Centers, you help us provide rental subsidies to secure affordable housing for youth, provide grocery cards to reduce food insecurity, and provide life skill training to increase the youth's capacity to live independently. Your donation additionally supports youth access to counseling, tenant education, financial literacy training, home economics training, and mentor and employment opportunities. If you want to support Rest Centers with a financial donation, please see the link in the bio for more details. If you want to stay in the loop about what Rest is doing to help our community shelter dignity and support youth experiencing homelessness, you can get to know us on LinkedIn or subscribe to the Rest Center's newsletter for updates. And most importantly, if you are a youth in Peel experiencing or are at risk of experiencing homelessness, we are here to help. Give us a call at 905-863-1118 to get in touch. Now, back to the episode. You initially brought this up in passing, and then you're like, oh, well, that's a different conversation. But no, I think this is actually a great conversation to ask this question. Why does it anger you that couch surfing is still a thing? Like, what do you mean when you say that?
Okay, what I mean by that is there's a lot of phrases that we use, and technically, if you're in any other field, I'm just thinking out loud right now, if you're in any other field, there's new technology, there's new phraseology, there's new language, there's new ideas that come up and change how you do that thing, whether it's architecture or fitness or business, whatever. There's some archaic terms because that used to be the way it was, but now there's a new term that captures what's happening now. So my heart was truly saddened when I was sitting in a meeting with the Region of Peel, and they're doing our briefings, human services. So Eileen Baird, Sean Baird, and them had come to my office. And 25 years ago, I was a housing coordinator and working with youth at risk. And today I am the second highest elected official in the city of Mississauga. And these people are coming to my office to sit down in my huge, what's bigger than a studio bachelor apartment from my office overlooking the Living Arts Center. And they sit down and they say the same phrase that I would tell parents when I was telling them the importance of having a housing program in Meadowvale, which is not downtown Toronto. It's suburbia. And I'm using the word couch surfing to illustrate what our youth are doing when they're going from one house to the other because they don't really want to run away and they don't know what resources are available to them. And they're just trying to buy time while they figure their life out. And to hear them in a professional setting say the same phrase I was using for imagery for parents 25 years ago saddened me to know that, one, it's still an issue, and two, the phrase hasn't changed because it's still the exact same thing 25 years later. We haven't figured this out yet. Yeah, and I just, in saying that, that's not an indictment against anyone working in the industry that's been doing this work the whole time, because I said we haven't figured this out. I'm not saying you haven't figured this out. Like, it's been on my heart as well. So this is something collectively, like, well, we need to continue to work. And so that's not a condemning statement. That's not an indictment against people who have been in the trenches the whole time while I've moved around. It's like, it inspires me to continue the work as opposed to discourages me from trying to do any more work.
Of course. I guess I can ask, how would you like to see us figure it out? And of course, I understand that you're now responsible for a bunch of different things. And on top of that, this is a huge question I'm asking of you off the top of your head. But like through the lens of youth experiencing homelessness, just because there's a variety of different reasons, like from failures in like the immigration system to aging out of foster care, family tragedy and dysfunction. There's so many different reasons that I think a lot of people don't understand as to why a child would be experiencing homelessness, because from what I've seen, a lot of people blame the kid, despite the fact that, you know, they are a kid. So understanding now that you have worked with youth at risk in the past, what would you want people to understand, or rather maybe what would you want parents to understand about the reality of being a kid in current year, or even 20 years ago, 30 years ago, that makes it more complicated to not only exist, but to experience homelessness? Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. Because I mean, if I was to answer your first, the way you framed it the first way, I would have said that it's tough, you know, when you're at a point where they're couch surfing, it's difficult. When you can connect with the parents while they're still in the home, it's a little bit easier. If you can connect with the kids while they're in their schools, it's easier. When you can connect with them when they're in middle school, it's easier. So, you know, there's a sense of like, you know, like the police say, are you working upstream? Like, I can help rescue people from the river all day long, or I can go further up the river and see where they're falling in and stop them from falling in. So when I was working at the dam, I started doing a program at Edenwood Middle School where we go in and talk about issues, youth related issues, and just have a forum and just get, you know, their mindset and just work through solutions and just talk stuff through. When I left the dam, Ken Dreifeld continued doing those same things. And to this day, they still run that program. And they still just go into schools. They just do proactive work in the middle schools and talk with kids while they're still connected, and just let them know that the dam is available. And parents will call and say, hey, I noticed this behavior change in my daughter. I know she talks about going to the dam. You know, have you noticed anything? Okay, cool. Thank you. That is more powerful than trying to figure out how to stop, you know, how to get kids housing when it's not too little too late by any means, but the proactive work is so powerful. And I think that's why the dam's been so successful, is because they've been able to convince people that, you know, that adage of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Like when you have a drop-in and a mentoring and, you know, these programs in the suburban setting before they end up downtown. Back in the day, we just ship all of our people downtown because we didn't have the social infrastructure in the region. You know, it was a tough sell. Now, you know, it's different. So I'm talking in circles a little bit, but the bottom line is there has to be more proactive work. There has to be more, you know, that ecosystem around the kids and just address those things at that point. There's some wonderful people in the appeal board who are doing some real great connecting work with families, and they're unsung heroes because they're not, you know, upper management. So they're, you know, they're Black women who are just working with a small set of schools, with a small set of parents, and they're having such a tremendous impact. And you'll never see the fruit of their work, because the benefit is someone goes back home at the end of the day and they have a meal and they go to bed. So you don't get the glory of, you know, finding them housing and finding them affordable housing and getting them a job. And like, you know what I mean? Like, it's that preventative work way upstream. You know, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't get you all the glory, but it's the most powerful work to do.
No, absolutely. I completely agree. We at Rest, but like, yes, we absolutely have like the exact same, like we have the exact same vision and we see it the exact same way. And so we absolutely see the, like, not only how difficult the work is to do, but how important the work is to, you know, reunify families and to keep kids together and to do what you can to keep family units cohesive. But yeah, no, because truly the reality of the housing market right now in Peel is that people are charging $1,000 for a bedroom. Like, not even a rental situation, a boarding situation. You get one bedroom. You're lucky if you don't have to share that bedroom. You're lucky if it's bigger than a shoebox, but you have to share a bathroom. You have to share laundry. You have to share a kitchen. And two out of three of those sharing things I just stated are illegal when it comes to a rental place. And that's why the situation goes from renting to boarding. And then on top of that, too, it's just, you know, when you start getting into the mindsets of landlords, and a lot of people are just in this strictly to make money. And I do fully understand that and respect that, of course, the rental market goes up because the mortgage market goes up. But, you know, you have so many people who are so hyper worried and hyper focused on getting just the simplest solution, just like a family with like two young kids. And like, that's all they want. That's all they're willing to consider. Suddenly, it becomes a lot harder of a sell to tell a child who is barely making any money at all because they're still in high school to say, oh yeah, we can get you your own place. And so a huge part of what we are trying to do as well as transition youth into independence is, you know, try to help them not only heal from the experiences they've had, but advocate for themselves and have those conversations with their families to have that sit down and come to a point of not only understanding, but acceptance and healing and growth beyond that point. Like, let's talk about the past. Let's talk about the ways in which you hurt me. Because, like, I don't want to fall into the trap of speaking in terms of generation this does this and generation that does that. But, you know, it's just the reality of the situation is that from what we've seen, a lot of parents are just very fed up with their kids, and a lot of kids are very fed up with their parents. Especially in the Black community, it's like, it seems like we don't know how to have these conversations. Like, we don't know how to articulate ourselves. And this just comes from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of like trauma, from racism in North America to the slave trade. It's just different things that we once had to do to survive, like put each other down so, you know, they're not taken away. Like, you know, it's like, oh, they're nothing special. You don't want to pay any attention to them. Back when it would save someone's life to do that, but now it's just it's part of the culture, it seems. There's so many of these little things that we just need to, as a community, rewire. And so going back to what you're saying about the importance of like reunification, in addition to fostering independence and stuff, it's that it looks different for every single youth. And so I really appreciate that this is something that like you fully see and you understand, because again, there's not a lot of people in your position who do.
My pleasure.
Okay. So I guess like, I don't want to ask you like, oh, what are you doing to bring awareness? Because that's, I think you've illustrated that. So I'm going to skip that question. But I think I want to ask more about, you know, what it's like being in office, being in your position. A little bit ago, you had talked about how, you know, you're sitting in your office and you're speaking with like Aileen Baird, Sean Baird, about the same stuff that you feel like you were talking about 30 years ago, but in the other direction, and feeling that there hasn't been a lot of change, but there has been a lot of conversation. And so there's a lot of bureaucracy involved in this, I can certainly imagine, when it comes to government frameworks. And so what I want to know is, how does a counselor in your position take things from discussion to action? How much red tape is there? How much of it can you have executive authority over?
That's a great question. And I'm still trying to figure that out with each specific matter that comes up. And the reason why I say it like that is because there are other people who share my concern. I know I'm not the only person who's concerned about it, but I also know that the people who are concerned about it also have different lenses and perspectives that I don't. So, you know, if I have a conversation with Sean Baird about this and I say, housing is terrible, he's like, I agree with you. So we need to do something. He's like, I agree. So we're going to change the budget. And we are, and he did it. Like they crafted a budget that said, you need $50 billion to solve this problem. The Region of Peel budget is $2 billion. So if we were to take every penny, not give another penny to police, don't worry about garbage collection, don't think about early childhood education or public health, every cent went to homelessness, it would take us 25 years to solve it. That's what he opened with. And then from there, scaled it back. So how much do you guys want to dedicate of the next year's budget to this problem? And then it puts it back in perspective. So I can't just snap my fingers and say, well, we'll just give more money to homelessness. You realize the complexity of it. You realize the history of it in terms of the province downloading all housing to the region and how, you know, inflation has gone up and how mortgage rates have gone up. And like you said, higher mortgages mean higher rents. And then, you know, you know, both members of the family have to work now, whereas before you can get away on one salary. It's so complex that the bureaucracy, I don't see it as like roadblocking bureaucracy. I see it as people giving me a context, and then we just have to be creative with this context to figure out what we're going to do, what's really important, and where can we move the needle. And that's what brings me full circle to support Amplify and Connect, because it's impossible. Like, I think that it's dismal. I talk to Sean, I say it all the time, like, this is dismal. Like, I mean, like 25 years at $2 billion and not looking at anyone else, like, that's impossible. So we need to recruit everybody. We need to have every nonprofit at the table. We need to have every person who has been just grinding with one staff person and 10 volunteers in their organization to be part of the conversation. And we need to give them the resources to do the work. It has to be a collective. So the bureaucracy doesn't bother me. I think I just need that bureaucracy. The bureaucracy gives me a context. And then I come back to support, amplify, and connect and say, thank you very much. I know that the dam's doing great work. I know that REST is doing great work. I know that Roots is doing great work. I know that X, Y, and Z are doing great work. How do we get them more than just core funding? How do we get more money in their hands so that they don't have to worry about staffing and that they can actually branch out to other programs that they see based on the people that they have in their room? That's where my focus is, because I know that like it's actually impossible for us to figure this out without bringing more people to the table.
That's really interesting, actually, to hear that figure of like it would take 25 years of, you know, 100% of the budget. So really what they're saying is it would take easily double that amount of time. But then I guess a question I have as a bit of a follow-up in that regard is, I guess another thing to consider too is where does that money go? There's a budget, but then what is it allocated towards? Like going back to the summit that we had attended last week, you know, they were discussing that like there's a housing crisis, absolutely, but there's two different types of housing crises. There's the lack of affordable housing for middle income families, and then there's the lack of deep cut affordable housing for people in poverty, which then leads them to homelessness. And once you're in homelessness, it is extremely difficult to get out. It goes back to also what we were saying about how important preventative work is and diversion, because it's just once you're in the cycle is so difficult to break. So then I guess, yeah, it's just, you know, we have the figures, we have the numbers, but I guess, are we looking at the right areas? Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. That's a really good question. And having the conversations at the region, they've had lots of conversations with everyone, with many of the people that were in the room at that conference, to understand from them where we need to put our energy. So a lot of energy is going to be put into the preventative work. A lot more, you know, I mean, because it's capital. You can spend $10 million and it gets you, you know, one building that houses 25 people. Or you can spend $10 million and do, you know, all kinds of preventative programs that address the issue upstream and support organizations that are still addressing kids while they're in school, so they're making better decisions and X, Y, and Z. You can do so much more in the earlier upstream energies. And that was the response of a lot of people who have spent their whole lives working in poverty and homelessness. So majority of the money is being spent preventative. Some of the money is spent on some of those in between interventions. And the last bit of the money is going to be spent on, you know, repurposing land that we already own, state of good repair for buildings that we already have on the books, that sort of thing, right? So instead of they're like, where do we get the most bang for our buck? And then they basically went out to all the service providers and all the organizations and got their feedback in terms of where they want to spend the money first. So I do have so much respect for Sean, Eileen, and all the team at the region that are working on this, because they are leaning on all of our partners in the community. Probably, I don't know if that's always been the case, but since I've been around in council, I've seen that they've been doing that of late. So I don't know what happened before me, but like, kudos to them for doing that right now.
This has been a wonderful conversation, and I still have my one question that no one's allowed to escape. But I guess before that, I do just want to thoroughly thank you for your time and for your perspective, because it's certainly, this is not an opportunity that a lot of people get to have. And so I'm really honored, truly, that you, like, you're taking the time you are to listen to community members, listen to service providers. So that said, where do you want this discussion to go? What should I and our listeners tackle first?
Where do I want this discussion to go? I would love for people to hear this podcast and just get a snapshot of the work. Like, I think I open with this. Like, I mean, like, for them to see the person behind the role, the person behind the seat, and to know that for those who are in this space of wanting to address homelessness and poverty, that you have an ally, you have someone who's locking arms with you that is in office. So, you know, reach out to me, reach out to my office. If you are a nonprofit, and especially if you are in Ward 9, that's the thing too, because you can't save the whole world. If you were in Meadowvale Central, Air Mills, Meadowvale Business Park, and you are a nonprofit, you're hearing this and you're like, I didn't know this guy actually cares about this stuff. Reach out to me. If you're doing a picnic, if you're doing a fundraiser, you want me to just amplify your message, I will. That sort of thing. Like, I want to come alongside those who are doing the work. I don't want to save the world. I want to be a part of the work that you're already doing.
That wraps up this episode of Homelessness in Hiding, Our Youth Between the Cracks. If you want to follow up with Counselor Martin Reed, all of his social media are in the description, and you can visit his team's website, ward9.ca, that's WARD9.ca, for more information. If you're interested in supporting a cause tackling youth homelessness, I invite you to visit our website, restcenters.org. That's RESTCENTRES.org to learn more about our mission and how you can support the cause. If you found solace here, learned something new, or think we have something of value to offer, you can subscribe to the show so you'll never miss an episode. Until next time, I'm Maya Moniz, signing off. This podcast has been brought to you by Rest Centers through the special dedication of our peer support leader, Maya Moniz, our Director of Youth Engagement, Romaine Redman, and Rest Executive Director and Founder, Dagma Koyi. This podcast is also brought to you by the Peel Alliance to End Homelessness and the special dedication of their Program Coordinator and Analyst, Daphne Nussbaum. The thoughts and opinions expressed in this podcast are exclusively those of the hosts and guests involved and have no affiliation with the Restoration and Empowerment for Social Transition Center,